This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Even if the Tigray forces are squeezed and overpowered, you may see a strong resistance, a guerrilla-type resistance, and that's possible. I don't see the Tigrayans being governed anytime soon from Addis. So we could be very well looking at a long, protracted situation.
That's the director of the International Crisis Group Africa Program on Ethiopia's military conflict with its independence-minded Tigray region. Details coming up also. Ghana's former leader, Jerry Rawlings, has died at age 73. And Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga has appeared before a UN tribunal in The Hague. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ethiopia's military conflict with its independence-minded Tigray region has raised fears of civil war in Africa's second most populous nation. It also raises concerns about regional instability spreading if the conflict continues. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
The conflict between the Ethiopian government and fighters loyal to the Tigray People's Liberation Front is entering its second week. Some 8,000 Ethiopians have crossed into Sudan for safety, and aid agencies expect more in the coming days. The conflict started when Tigray fighters attacked a federal government position last week in what the government called an attempt to loot weapons and equipment. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed ordered military action to end the armed uprising. Comfort Ero is the International Crisis Group Africa Program Director.
Right now, what we see is more and more fighting, more and more entrenched positions by both sides. Even if the Tigray forces are squeezed and overpowered, you may see a strong resistance, a guerrilla-type resistance, and that's possible. I don't see the Tigrayans being governed anytime soon from Addis. So we could be very well looking at a long, protracted situation.
Tensions have been building since September when Tigray region, one of Ethiopia's 9 regional states, defiantly held a local election after Abiy postponed the polls due to the COVID-19 pandemic. There has been less information coming from the conflict area and difficulty assessing humanitarian needs since the government shut down the internet Wednesday. Thomas Murphy is a sub-Saharan Africa intelligence analyst for the Risk Advisory Group. He says government failure to defeat the Tigray fighters may cause more trouble for the country.
The likelihood of a coup would almost certainly increase if the military fails to defeat the TPLF. And, you know, that would probably come from factions linked to the TPLF who have previously been highly influential in the government. In terms of, I guess, wider implications, Ethiopia is in a very fragile state at the moment. And I think the likelihood or the potential for tensions to escalate or to deteriorate into, I guess, pockets of conflict involving other ethnic actors across the country is probably very high.
On Sunday, the Prime Minister appointed new army chief and intelligence head to lead the war against the Tigray region. Political expert Awol Alo says solving the country's problems through guns could divide the country even further.
You know, this is a highly divided country along ethnic lines. The current constitution provides for people's right to self-determination in the sense of the ability to determine their political and cultural status, but also the right to become an independent state. So the decision of the Prime Minister to settle a political dispute through an armed confrontation would likely lead to the disintegration of the Ethiopian state into multiple smaller republics. And that, of course, would have a considerable ramification, not just for Ethiopia, but also for the Horn of Africa.
In 2019, Abiy won the Nobel Peace Prize for his effort to end Ethiopia's hostilities with Eritrea, bringing political reform to the country and mediating disputes in Sudan, South Sudan, Kenya and Somalia. Abiy has ruled out talks with the Tigray regional leaders, but Ero of ICG says comprehensive national dialogue could save Ethiopia and the region.
the continental body in the form of the Africa Union, one of the most important allies for the Africa Union, but also for Ethiopia, the EU, are all on the same page in terms of what needs to be done to prevent this conflict from spiraling out of control and from sucking in the region where we already have, you know, a very fragile transition in Sudan, a country like Somalia, about to turn an important page in its own crisis, South Sudan's very slow transition in its own unity government. So this is not a good time for the Horn of Africa region, with one of its most important pivotal countries now going into a war footing.
The government in Addis Ababa insists the military operation will end when the north of the country is liberated and new leadership is restored in the region. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ghana's former president Jerry Rawlings died today at age 73. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to VOA's Nightline Africa host Peter Clotie here in Washington.
I got a call from the party that he established, the National Democratic Congress, telling me about the sad news that he passed away at the Kolebu Teaching Hospital, Ghana's premier hospital in the capital Accra, early this morning, local time. He had been admitted there for the past week over undisclosed ailment. Because of the way he is popular, people thought that if they had informed the general public that he had been admitted there, a lot of people would have come there, so they kept it on the quiet. And then when I got the call, I asked them what led to his death. They were a little cagey about it because they want the family to confirm it before telling me what really happened. But the Ghanaian media is awash with speculations about possible COVID-19 complications, although that has not been confirmed yet. I have not confirmed it, so I cannot say with absolute certainty that is what caused his death. So I await the family to confirm it.
Well, until we get that confirmation, let's look a bit at his legacy. What is his legacy?
Many Ghanaians attribute the country's peace and stability currently to President John Jerry Rawlings. Since he came to power with his latest coup, he had stabilized the country in spite of accusations that there were gross human rights abuses when he came to power. There were several attempts to overthrow him. He succeeded in preventing those attempted coup d'etats. And then in 1992, he decided to contest as a civilian when he left the army as a flight lieutenant. And before then, he had liberalized the airways. We used to have only the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation for TV and radio. But he liberalized the airwaves so individual Ghanaians could purchase, you know, FM station bandwidth and establish their independent news media. That is why the country is awash with newspapers, independent newspapers, radio and television stations across the country. Then in 1992, he stood, as I earlier indicated, as a presidential candidate for the National Democratic Congress, or NDC. He won the 4 years he was re-elected, and then he handed over peacefully when his then Vice President John Evans Atta Mills was defeated by then main opposition leader John Ajikum Kufuor. So many Ghanaians see him as the Ghanaian or the leader who led Ghana to re-embrace constitutional rule in 1992.
And you've met him and interviewed him a number of times. Can you maybe talk a little bit, share maybe an anecdote or two about personally what he was like when you met him?
Well, he's a friendly guy. The last time I physically met him was over 7 years ago in Ghana. I went to see and greet his wife when his wife got to know that I was in town. She invited me to come. So I met him. We spoke at length because some of us grew up under his rule. So we talked about a lot of things, including the transformation of the education system, the first come, first serve policy that he came with, because, you know, Ghana has a lot of traditional leaders, kings and chiefs and all that. So sometimes some people, because they are royal, they feel they are more important than others. When he came to power, he decided that when you go to a place, for a service, the person who comes first gets served first, irrespective of your party affiliation or importance in society. And then we also talked about some of the excesses during his reign. Of course, it was a military regime, so some military officials took advantage of the situation and all that. On his 60th birthday, I interviewed him for VOA, and I was trying to find out what his regrets were. And he was telling me that, hindsight being 2020, there were certain things that he could have done better. But all in all, Ghanaians credit him for stabilizing the country and re-embracing democratic rule where every vote counts. And so he was proud of that.
VOA Africa will have more on the death of former Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings online and on our radio programs in the coming days. Tanzanian opposition politician and former presidential candidate Tundu Lissu has left the country for Belgium a week after a failed nationwide protest to reject a presidential election that he claims was marred by widespread irregularities. His departure for Europe comes after he took refuge for more than a week at the German ambassador's residence, citing threats to his life. Charles Kombe reports from Dar es Salaam.
2 weeks have passed since Tanzania voted in a national and local elections that put incumbent President John Magufuli of the ruling Party of the Revolution, or CCM, into power for a second term. The main challenger, opposition candidate Tundu Lissu, decried the opposition presidential poll as rigged with voter intimidation and corruption. On Tuesday, he fled to Belgium after claiming that his life was in danger.
Inabidi kwanza niwe salama. Ili tuweze kupambana lazima kwanza tuwe salama.
Lissu says, in order for us to continue with the struggle, we have to be safe. I'm leaving to be safe, Lissu says. He adds that there's no safety continuing to stay in Tanzania. He says he's not escaping, but is leaving to open a new battlefield. Political analyst Azaveli Loitama says the government will use Lissu's departure to delegitimize the political opposition. He says the government will convince Tanzanians the opposition consists of so-called imperialists who are going to create chaos and leave the country when things get worse. Political analyst Abdulkarim Watiki says he sees this as a political game. How can you threaten a person who has 1 million votes, even didn't reach 2 million? Atiki asks. He dismisses that as a political tactic. 26-year-old Dar es Salaam resident Ahmadia Yahya says the situation leaves many people in a dilemma.
Wanajaribu kuwapa maswali wananchi sasa kwamba inawezekana walitarajia maandamano.
They leave citizens with many questions that maybe they expected demonstrations to happen and then leave the country in an insecure situation, he says. Ahmadia says as time goes by, maybe they will get to know what is behind the scenes. Maria Thomas says Lissu's departure is good for his safety, adding he has escaped death in a failed assassination attempt before.
Kuondoka pia ameepusha mengi kwa sababu ukiangalia mwaka 2017 pia alinusulika kifo.
I think he has avoided a lot because looking at 2017, he escaped death due to political issues, says Maria. She asks that if he has claimed that his life was in danger, it is good he lives and it's better he left because maybe there was something that was expected to come. But the Tanzanian government has dismissed the allegations. Hassan Abasi is a government spokesperson. Those allegations by the opposition are not new. They have been doing so every now and then. After they failed in a democratic process, they create lies, he says. Abasi adds that is why Tanzanian citizens have ignored the allegations and continue with their duties. Lissu is the third opposition leader to leave the country due to perceived post-election security risks. Last week, former opposition lawmaker Godbless Lema fled to Kenya, while Lazaro Nyalandu, another former opposition politician, tried to leave the country to neighboring Kenya. Charles Kombe for VOA News in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga made his first appearance yesterday before a UN tribunal in The Hague. the former radio station owner and tea and coffee tycoon, was arrested in a Paris suburb in May after a more than two-decade manhunt. The 85-year-old is accused of financing and arming ethnic Hutu militias that killed 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus during a 100-day period in 1994. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, who has been closely following the case, describes Kabuga's hearing and what came out of it in a conversation with International Edition's Laurie London.
Mr. Kabuga was brought into the courtroom in a wheelchair. He was wearing a three-piece suit, very well turned out. He followed the proceedings but did not speak at any time, other than to tell his defense lawyer that he could hear the translation of the court proceeding. He looked frail, and the defense lawyers were saying that this is a man who is psychologically and mentally very frail and is finding the process very tiring. They said that one of the problems when they read the indictments to him was that he was tired. It was difficult for him to follow it.
Tell us a little bit about that. This was his first appearance, but what was this hearing actually about?
It was a pre-trial hearing just to ascertain where it is now with investigations into the prosecution, what the prosecution is looking at, and to see where it is with witnesses, to make sure also that Mr. Kabuga knows what is going to be happening in the months ahead. And the question that the presiding judge put to Mr. Kabuga was, do you understand these seven counts that you are charged with? Those are five relating to genocide and two relating to crimes against humanity. And Mr. Kabuga's lawyer said he understood them and he knew some of them, at which stage the judge said, okay, well, we are now going to read you the indictment. And that took 1 hour and 10 minutes for this indictment to be read. And the main point of it was, through it all, that they found on every count that Mr. Kabuga could have used his power, his influence, and his position of authority to prevent broadcasts against the Tutsis, to prevent attacks against Tutsis, but that he failed not only to stop these broadcasts, but he failed to report to police what was being done, what people were being asked to do against Tutsis. And through this, he failed to stop the killing, harming, and mistreatment of Tutsis.
Did he enter a plea?
No, he didn't. His lawyer said that he would not be speaking, and therefore the court registered a plea of not guilty.
And so where does this case go from here?
Now we are looking at the prosecution getting everything together, getting witness statements again, making sure of witness protection. Presiding judge did, however, make a point of saying to both the prosecution and the defense that he expects this case to be dealt with speedily, because he's seen too many of these types of cases take too long to come to court.
His victims and victim survivors have waited a very long time to see any sort of justice, and he's 85 years old, so I'm sure that also is potentially playing a role in why the judge wants this to be expeditious.
Oh, indeed. Let's not forget that it was a 26-year-long manhunt for Monsieur Kabuga, so age as well as how long it's taken, and the fact that some of these UN tribunals, particularly that came up in court, they're really having trouble finding the funding to be able to continue these prosecutions. So they really do realise that it's difficult to get these prosecutions and it's difficult to get the support they need, given that it is so long since the genocide took place and that some countries are not giving as much money to the UN for this as they used to.
Investment arms of the US government are pouring tens of billions of dollars into African economies through private investment initiatives, which represent a drastic shift from the old model of development aid. But do these splashy programs make a difference? VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
How big is the U.S.'s commitment to Africa? Let us count the ways, says Victoria Whitney, Chief Operating Officer of the Prosper Africa Initiative, launched in 2018. In the past year, she said, the initiative, which spans 17 U.S. government agencies, has facilitated more than $22 billion worth of deals in more than 30 African countries, with agreements focusing on small and medium-sized African businesses. This week, she announced new measures that aim to harness private U.S. investment and pour it into African entrepreneurship.
This new continent-wide program is going to provide a really wide range of services. Think business consulting and transaction facilitation, targeted policy interventions, really the core tenets of the Prosper Africa Initiative, and is expected to deliver billions more dollars in exports and investment and create hundreds of thousands of jobs by 2026. I really think this new program is going to be a game changer.
Prosper Africa is one of the many U.S. government initiatives aimed at bringing private investment into the continent. The International Development Finance Corporation is the federal government's development finance institution. It works on financing private development projects in lower and middle-income countries. Since its launch at the beginning of 2020, it has invested more than $8 billion in 300 projects in Africa, along with the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is working on $10 billion worth of deals. Whitney.
Adam Bowler, Prosper Africa's executive chair as well as CEO of the DFC, he describes it really well in the way that he does. He said, for years, we lacked the type of investment infrastructure to really be on the board. And when people would sort of say, where is the United States? Well, we didn't have the best answer. But because of the Build Act, because of Prosper Africa, we do have an answer. We're saying we're new, but we're big time, as he had said, and you're going to see much, much more from us.
Martin Davis, Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa at Deloitte, told VOA he's noticed an increase in private investment initiatives from American investors and that it makes sense.
I think there was previously a lot stronger interest in the infrastructure and infrastructure assets, but I think the challenges of navigating through often sort of very challenging public sector bureaucracies has resulted in a dampening, I think, to an extent of some of the infrastructure plays. I think, however, going forward, I think U.S. multinationals remain incredibly well positioned, particularly in terms of brand recognition and the like, toward the African continent.
Sean Cairncross, CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, another U.S. government initiative, is working to build a global investment platform to attract U.S. capital to Africa. Investing in African entrepreneurs, he said, just makes sense and aligns with this administration's foreign policy.
This partnership's well aligned with our key priorities, which is seeking new and innovative opportunities for blended finance. It's a priority that this administration is, like I say, 100% behind, and the interagency coordination on this is, I think, an unheralded piece of the Trump administration's foreign development push.
Whitney acknowledges that the world of investment seems abstract and complicated. So she said, here's a real-life example of how the program has worked for one Ghanaian entrepreneur.
Eugenia Akwete first started a Shea Cosmetics company, and she turned to USAID for technical assistance, as well as some market intelligence, matchmaking, and networking support. And then she also received seed capital and technical assistance from USADF, both Prosper Africa leading partners. And she attended numerous USAID-sponsored training sessions and conferences.
Today, she said, Akwete's products are available in more than 1,000 Target stores in the U.S. And on the continent, 10,000 shea nut pickers have jobs. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Barrow, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the